From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, will taking redistricting out of the hands of lawmakers improve state government? Also, a local business leader warns against circling the wagons during the recession. And the soulful country pop of Sacramento singer Kate Gaffney. But first, billions of dollars of infrastructure spending in California was stopped today. The state's top finance leaders met this morning and voted to cut off nearly $4 billion worth of bond funding for schools, roads, and other construction. This decision affects nearly 2,000 projects across the state, including the Sacramento rail yards and the Highway 65 bypass in Placer County. Joining us with more details is Jenny O'Mara, Capital Public Radio's Deputy Capital Bureau Chief. Jenny, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Why did California's finance leaders decide to stop funding all of these infrastructure projects?
Well, essentially, the short answer is money, or more specifically, cash. The goal here is to preserve the state's dwindling cash reserves that are essentially scheduled or slated to run out as early as February.
So they were trying to rein in spending so that money would be available for core operating expenses?
It's in short, yes. This is essentially the group that did this. The top finance officers are essentially, it's this particular account that they manage that it not only gives money for public works projects and lends money to those public works projects, but it's also used to help smooth out the state's cash needs. And essentially, they're having to address that with more and more demands on the state's cash flow.
Who exactly made this decision, and in what capacity?
Well, this is called the state's Pooled Money Investment Board. It's made up of the state treasurer, Bill Lockyer, the state controller, John Chung, and the governor's head of the Department of Finance, Mike Genest. So they met today to make this. And essentially, again, they manage what's called the state's Pooled Money Investment Account. The account provides loans to both bond-funded public works projects and, again, to the state general fund to help meet cash flow needs. And essentially, the problem is that the state's ongoing budget problem has added more and more demands on this account. And so they've essentially had to pull that funding from public works projects to make that money available.
You were at this morning's meeting. Did you have a chance to talk with any of the three board members to get their reaction to their decision?
We did. Yes, I was at the board meeting. It was essentially standing room only. A lot of interested parties from the construction and industry and from schools and that sort of thing. But of course, the three top finance leaders took it upon themselves to say it was a regrettable action. One of them was State Controller John Chung.
Well, this is incredibly difficult. We're going to impact the lives of so many people, especially of those who are going to have to suffer job losses during the holiday season. Unfortunately, it's a much-needed issue as we run out of cash in February.
As I understand, we're talking about $3.8 billion here of infrastructure bond funding through the end of June. That's assuming there isn't a resolution to the budget crisis in Sacramento. What can, if anything, can the governor and the legislature do about this decision this morning to stop all this infrastructure spending?
Well, essentially, all three of the financial leaders used this as an opportunity to really urge the legislature to come to some sort of an agreement on the budget. All have said that unpopular decisions may very well need to be made. Republican lawmakers have so far really resisted tax increases. They have said they have put forward a proposal with larger amounts of cuts and no such tax hikes, but others have said that's really just not going to cover it because essentially the state is facing a nearly $42 billion shortfall over the next year and a half, and nearly $15 billion of that is in the current year alone. But the fiscal leader said, please, you know, to the legislature, you know, do something soon. They need essentially a better profile in the credit market for them to be able to sell bonds to replenish this fund.
So if I understand correctly, if the legislature manages to bridge the budget deficit, then that would rebuild confidence in the markets and California's ability to repay bonds. And then this infrastructure funding could, at least in theory, be freed up again.
Essentially, yes, it would allow them to sell the bonds. And what they're saying is what they really need is a longer-term solution, essentially something that is going to solve the state's problem over the longer term, at least over the next year and a half, to help them get a better foothold in the credit market.
Can you give us an idea of some of the projects, especially local projects, Sacramento area projects that would be affected by this?
There's a lengthy list that was given out by the treasurer's office, but they also included some particulars in terms of some school funding projects that are going on that have the likelihood of being affected. They include some rehabilitation work at Sacramento High School, some emergency repairs at a couple of elementary schools in Lodi, and other emergency repairs at an elementary school in Walnut Grove. I mean, this is where essentially you get down to the nitty gritty. And again, they're also saying the problem is that these are going to affect construction jobs. So it just has this trickle down effect of you know, losing more jobs in this rough economy.
And finally, Jenny, since this is predicated on the budget, any news on the state budget?
Well, there was a meeting last night of the Assembly. The Democratic lawmakers put forth a plan that was not approved. Apparently, there is both houses are scheduled to meet this evening. Apparently, the Democrats are putting forth another plan that is expected to be voted on, that we're gathering the particulars on at this hour. And so they are meeting in session. Stay tuned, as they say.
Yes. Jenny O'Mara, Capital Public Radio's Deputy Capital Bureau Chief, joining us from our Capital Bureau in downtown Sacramento. Jenny, thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome.
This is Insight. When the economy goes south, people tend to rein in their spending. But in an essay in the latest newsletter of the Sacramento Metro Chamber, CEO Matt Mayhood says people should be careful not to overreact. He joins us to talk more about that. Matt Mayhood, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, thank you.
Why did you decide to suggest that people think twice about reining in their spending?
Well, I think we want people to be obviously responsible with their finances, but we also don't want people to overreact about what they're hearing in the media. And if, you know, people have a pretty steady job with a steady income and their job seems pretty secure, let's not overreact and, you know, further the contraction of the economy by not spending.
I've often heard that recessions are at least partly psychological, separate from the economic fundamentals. Do you think that's part of the problem here?
Well, I think that's part of the problem. Obviously, our economy has some pretty significant issues that's getting a lot of attention at all levels of government. Obviously, there's a lot of people being negatively impacted by the recession and their own personal finances and their jobs. So we can't minimize that. But I do believe that there tends to be a little bit of an overreaction by some folks. And, you know, we could certainly make the problem worse if we overreact.
Your organization, the Sacramento Metro Chamber, is the umbrella chamber of commerce for the Sacramento region. Have you been hearing from your members in the various industries and sectors that they have noticed a significant cutback in spending in this region in the last month or two?
Well, we've heard from a lot of different sectors that they're seeing a pullback. So what we've tried to do is try to, you know, counteract that and encourage people to shop locally. A great deal of money is spent by our own residents, either shopping online or taking a trip down to the San Francisco Bay Area to go shopping in the malls and the stores down there. So we're trying to encourage people to shop locally, keep their business local. It keeps the sales taxes that they pay local, and it helps keep the money here and keep jobs here.
In the Sacramento region, there are many cities and counties, so you could shop locally in several different ways. I mean, you could stay in your own city or you could go to the adjacent city. That doesn't necessarily help you. How do you suggest people deal with that issue in an area like this with so many jurisdictions?
Well, you know, economic development and economic impacts aren't bound by jurisdictional boundaries. So what is good when you shop in the city of Sacramento is also good for what's happening in Citrus Heights or Roseville or Folsom. We're a regional economy, and so just trying to keep the dollars here in the Sacramento region are important, because a lot of people who work in downtown Sacramento live in Folsom, so they're obviously probably spending dollars in both of those places, and it's good for the region's economy.
Matt Mayhood is president and the CEO of the Sacramento Metro Chamber. In the Chamber's latest newsletter, he warned against, quote, circling the wagons during this recession. But has the Sacramento Metro Chamber trimmed its spending too?
We're feeling the effects of, a down economy as well from, the overall support of our members. Although, we had a new membership orientation this morning and the room was full. And people often come to chambers of commerce in times like this looking to gain visibility for their business in order to network their business, looking for new customers and clients. So chambers of commerce are often the place people go to survive and thrive in difficult times. But with that said, we're budgeting back in 2009 and preparing ourselves for probably less revenue than 2008.
Matt, since we have you on the phone, I'd like to ask for your reaction to this morning's decision by top state finance leaders to stop infrastructure bond fund spending through the end of June because of the state's ongoing budget crunch. A lot of Sacramento region projects are affected by this, most notably in terms of dollars, the Sacramento rail yards. What do you make of all this, and what do you think should be done?
Well, it's obviously it's bad news for not only the Sacramento region's economy, but for the state's economy as well. But, I don't think the state had any choice but to do that, given the state budget crisis. What really needs to happen is both the Democrats and the Republicans need to come together, put all partisanship aside, and put together a budget deal that is good for California. And that's going to require some very difficult decisions to be made on cutting spending, cutting programs that have been started or evolved over the last couple of years. We simply can't afford to pay for those programs any longer, as well as looking at revenue enhancements or, I'd hate to say it, but new taxes or revenue opportunities that do not significantly impact an already lagging economy. So don't put all the burdens of a new revenue on the backs of business, because it'll simply cause a ripple effect in the economy that could potentially cause a loss, an additional loss in jobs. So there needs to be a very balanced approach from the state, from making spending cuts and looking at revenue enhancements, particularly on the short term. I'd like to see short-term revenue enhancements, not long-term. These are new taxes that we're going to have to live for forever and ever.
What do you think of the strategy of the Republicans in the state legislature, whereby they opposed the plans that the Democrats and the governor were presenting, but only very recently came up with a detailed plan themselves and have definitely focused very heavily on avoiding any kind of tax increase?
Well, I think that's a typical strategy of the Republicans, is try to prevent additional tax increases. It's kind of a baseline position of Republicans, is they believe that less government is better. I do believe both parties need to find a balanced approach somewhere in the middle that brings the solution home for the state of California. And there's difficult decisions. Both parties are going to need to give something to get something, and I'm hoping both parties come together very soon, because our state certainly needs the balanced budget, and we certainly need these bond monies to get out to the community in order for us to have a better shot at getting out of this recession in 2009.
And finally, Matt, there's an irony in today's news from the state finance leaders suspending bond funding on infrastructure projects, because President-elect Obama has promised that he's going to increase spending on infrastructure significantly very early in his administration to try and help jumpstart the economy. Where do you stand on heavy government investment in infrastructure during a recession?
Well, I think, you know, it's proven in past history that oftentimes government needs to step in and provide a stimulus funding mechanism that gets people back to work. And then usually where there's public financing, private financing usually follows. Private investment will follow public financing, public investment. So I think it's a good opportunity, or it's a good way for us to stimulate the economy. Private investment will soon follow, and I think it's a good way to get people back to work. With that said, I think it's imperative that the Sacramento region make sure that we're clearly aligned on what projects we want to fund with the stimulus package, and we ensure that the Sacramento region gets its fair share, as our economy is significantly impacted by this downturn, and we want to get people back to work.
Matt Mayhood of the Sacramento Metro Chamber. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet. Anytime.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, will taking redistricting out of the hands of lawmakers improve state government? We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did something in Insight particularly please you? Email us and tell us what it was and why you liked it at insight@capradio.org. California's prisons are overcrowded and judges are trying to decide if the conditions violate prisoners' rights. On the next Insight, experts and stakeholders diagnose the problem and tell you how they'd solve it. Also, we'll check in with a meteorologist about the weather this weekend and next Christmas week. California voters approved a redistricting proposition last month, but will Prop 11 actually shake up California government, as supporters claimed, or is it simply creating a new, unaccountable and bureaucratic system for drawing state legislative district boundaries? Our two guests will help us sort through this. They are Tim Hodson, director of the Center for California Studies at Sacramento State, and Steve Maviglio, Democratic Party strategist, publisher of the website California Majority Report, and also Sacramento State political communications instructor. Tim, Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tim, before we talk about what's going to happen under Prop 11 first, could you remind us of the arguments in favor of taking redistricting power away from lawmakers?
Sure. The proponents of Proposition 11 argued that it was an inherent conflict of interest for the legislature to draw its own district lines, and that it would be better done by a panel of nonpartisan or at least bipartisan panel that would have things other than incumbent reelection as their priority.
Do you happen to think that there is an inherent conflict of interest?
Well, having played a role in the 1981 redistricting and having been in charge of the Senate's redistricting in 1991, no, I don't think there's an inherent conflict of interest. I do think it was time for reform, though.
We'll get to that in a moment, but let's go to Steve Maviglio. Steve, could you remind us of the arguments in favor of what was the status quo? In other words, why it was appropriate or at least okay for lawmakers to draw legislative district boundaries?
Well, I think even most opponents of Prop 11 thought the status quo was unacceptable and indefensible. But I think what we came up with was a solution that is not defensible and that it's going to create more problems than it solves. The current system protected many of incumbents, but with the turnover in the legislature because of term limits, actually no one in the assembly voted for the plan that kept them in office. So this misnomer of actually they're writing a plan to protect themselves didn't happen.
I see. Tim, you said, although in your opinion there was no necessary conflict of interest in the system whereby lawmakers draw their own boundaries, you said it was time for reform. Why?
Well, I think the legislature is like any other group of human beings. They are perfectly capable of doing a good job, particularly if there is an incentive, a carrot or a stick, to make them do it. When in 1980 and in 2001, there was no real stick, so the legislature's plans went to the least common denominator, which was let's protect the parties and let's protect the incumbents. In 71 and 91, or particularly in 91, there was an incentive in the form of the Voting Rights Act, the Federal Voting Rights Act. And the plans that the legislature developed in 91 were not bad. They were turned down by the courts, but they were not bad.
And Steve, you said that the solution that was arrived at, i.e. Prop 11, was not defensible. Why?
Well, the sixth time was the charm for this. When the proponents of redistricting reform talked about redistricting reform, it always lost. Because nobody knows nor cares about redistricting reform in the real world. So this time the campaign was about firefighters getting the money they needed for more trucks. It was about making the legislature more responsible. It wasn't about drawing district lines, and it won barely, by the way. 44% of the people that went to the polls actually voted for it. There was a big drop-off.
Well, given that probably a certain percentage of the people who do know and care about redistricting are listening right now, we'll also concede that probably most people don't care that much about it. Tim, are people right not to care much about redistricting?
No, they should care about it. To sound like a professor for a second instead of recovering gerrymandering. Redistricting is at the very heart of our entire political system. We have members who represent us in legislatures. And those districts are based on population. So the way that you draw district lines guarantees that communities are going to be represented or effectively represented or not. It's very important that we have equal population in districts so that a district that represents a very affluent area doesn't have any more political clout or any more votes in the legislature than an equally populous district in a poor area.
What about you, Steve? Do you think people should, the general public, should actually care about this?
Absolutely, but portraying this as the silver bullet is going to be a disaster because what we're going to do is going to end up reforming this reform because redistricting is just about trade-offs. It's going to be substituting one set of lines for another, and there's going to be people very unhappy with the new set of lines because of the detailed criteria that was laid out, which we probably get into in a little bit. Minorities are going to be very upset about this. There's going to be endless lawsuits, and this will go on for years. This is not over.
We're talking about Proposition 11, the redistricting constitutional amendment that was passed by California voters last month. My guests are Tim Hodson, Director of the Center for California Studies at Sacramento State, and Steve Maviglio, Democratic Party strategist. Tim, let's talk a bit more specifically about Prop 11. What would change?
Well, let me go
what
back
will
one.
Change, I should say.
Sure. Let me go back one thing though. The last in 1981, the legislature did redistricting, and the last lawsuit was settled in 1989. So a commission is not going to create any fewer or more lawsuits. It's inherent in the process. Everybody who doesn't like the result sues. What will happen?
We need to brace ourselves. It's a little complicated.
Yes. In fact, I tried to summarize just the process for selecting the commission members, and it took me 3 pages. But we don't have that long, so I'll summarize it even more. There's basically a 7-step process to selecting the commission members. Californians in the summer of 2010 are going to be able to submit their names to the state auditor. The state auditor will then compare those names against a very complicated list of criteria. Neither Steve or I, for example, are eligible to serve on the commission or be staff because we don't fit the purity for 10 years. The auditor then gets a list of qualified applicants. The state auditor then selects at random 3 licensed auditors who will then review the applicant pool and select 60 who are the most qualified. And these 60 have to be divided into 3 equal groups of Democrats, Republicans, and others, either declined or state or minor party. The legislative leaders, the 4 leaders the 2 Republican leaders in the legislature and the 2 Democratic leaders, then get to veto up to 2 applicants each. Of the remaining, the auditor then randomly selects 8, wow, of whom 3 have to be Democrats, 3 have to be Republicans, and 2 other. Those 8 then go back to the pool and select a remaining 6, 2 Democrats, 2 Republicans, and 2 independents, and those 14 are the commission.
Oh, my goodness. Well, congratulations, Tim, on such a concise summary. But why is it so complicated?
Because it's a cockamamie scheme. it's probably the least cockamamie of all of them that have come down the pike. But joking aside, I helped craft the arguments against some of the earlier initiative reforms, and my colleagues and I did too good of a job. We poisoned the idea of having retired judges And then, so if you're going to have an independent commission, who do you go to? Well, if you can't do judges, then you got to go to the general public, and that means you have to have some sort of complicated vetting process to get people who really want to do it and know how to do it.
Steve Maviglio, could you respond to what Tim's just been saying?
Yeah, I mean, this is like the political version of American Idol, though the least talent and the least knowledge is the people that are getting selected. So it's like having a doctor perform an operation, but the doctor wouldn't have been able to go to medical school, ever take a course, ever had any experience. So we're turning this over to a bunch of amateurs that are going to be picked like lottery balls coming out of the chute, which to me doesn't guarantee the best expertise.
Tim, setting aside its complexity, do you think there's a reasonable chance that it would produce genuinely qualified people up to doing this very complicated task?
I think it is possible. I think that the criteria for membership on the commission or be it staff is extraordinarily harsh. For example, if you have given $2,000 to any candidate in the last 10 years, you're ineligible, even if that candidate was your brother-in-law. But I do think it's possible to produce. I've already received inquiries from a number of people who are active in local LAFCO, local agency formation organizations that have experience in drawing boundaries for cities and school districts, and they're interested in participating. Hopefully the legislature can come up in the next couple of years with some additional statutes that will say, for example, that a commission member has to go to reapportionment school for a month and understand what the problems are.
Steve Maviglio, what do you think will come of this new system? Do you think there will be any benefits, in your opinion, that will come from it? Do you see any specific problems that are likely to come of it?
Yeah, first of all, just agreeing on a plan requires 50% of the commission plus one. So we see how well they're doing down the street in the Capitol agreeing on anything, and this has a different kind of threshold that's going to create more problems. I think right out of the gate, we're going to get lawsuits from a number of organizations on the commission. I think ultimately there'll be a lack of agreement, and then it'll go to the California Supreme Court. And that's just what the voters rejected with Prop 77 a few years before. And even if there is a plan, then it's subject to a referendum. And I could see the Democratic Party and probably hundreds of other organizations voting and fighting against that referendum on it. So, like I said, this is a long way from being over.
Tim Hodson, this form of redistricting reform or change, if one prefers, is supposed to help shake up state government. It's supposed to introduce a bit more competition into the system. Is that likely under the system? Do you think we'd see significant changes in the kind of lawmakers and in the party breakdown in the legislature?
Well, Steve mentioned a minute ago that this isn't a silver bullet. It's more like an aluminum bullet. There are going to be changes, but if they're not going to be significant, they're not going to be earth-shattering. We're going to have, if the commission does the plans, it will look very much like the legislature did in the 1990s. In the 90s, there were 15 to 20 competitive assembly districts. Today, there's about 8 to 10. In the 1990s, there were 6 or 8 Senate districts that were truly competitive, and there's only about 2 or 3 now. So there will be an increase. You want to make it sound dramatic, I can say it will double the number of competitive seats. However, the reality is that over 80% of all Californians live in communities that are safe Republican or safe Democratic, and no redistricting plan, no matter how it's done, is going to change that. It will be a change in the margins. And as Steve said, look at what's going on downtown right now. What would be happening? Democrats need to pick up 3 or 4 votes from Republicans. Well, what would happen if you had 3 or 4 Republicans who were in very competitive seats and having to face not punishment by a Republican electorate in the primary, but the consequences of holding up the budget at a general election? It might change the dynamics.
I see. Steve Maviglia, you've worked for some top lawmakers in the legislature, although you're not currently working there. Without naming any names, you know, behind the scenes, behind closed doors, what do state lawmakers think about the various attempts to change the way districts are drawn in California?
Well, the reason there was no movement out of the legislature, because it's a third rail for a legislator. Nobody wants to lose their district because that's what they own. We're elected for them. They're very scared of being thrown into new territory. So that's been the hesitancy in the Republicans, and because it needs a two-third vote out of the legislature, you never got the bipartisan agreement you needed unless it was a so-called backroom deal.
Yeah. If you two were put in charge of yet another overhaul of redistricting in California, what would each of you think would be the basis of the ideal system? It could be something that's been in the past, or it could be something you've had in your mind forever, but no one does it. Let's start with Tim Hodson.
I would let the legislature be the legislature. Let them adopt redistricting plans, but instead of having it go to the governor to be signed or vetoed, and governors are just as responsible for gerrymanders as anybody else, have it go to a panel of judges. So the legislature can say, we know that if we don't do a good job, if we do too selfish of a job, there's going to be this independent panel that will give it back to us to tell us to do it over again. So that would be the incentive to do it right, which they are perfectly capable of doing.
And do you see any prospect of that coming about?
Nope.
And Steve Maviglio, if you could draw up the way district boundaries are drawn in California, how would you do it?
You know, I actually, it's scary to say this in public, but I actually have faith in the legislature because they're all accountable. This commission is accountable to absolutely no one. We can't vote them out. We can't vote them in. And the legislature, the only change I would see is having the plan put on the ballot for the voters to say, okay, we like what you did or didn't like it did. But at least we'd be able to respond to the people that are drawing these things and say, you guys did a lousy job and I'm voting against you for that. And we don't have that system now.
And finally, why do you think this particular reform passed? Because there is this general lack of interest in redistricting among the general public. Why do you think they passed this one, Tim?
Well, two reasons. Parochial reason is that this really is one of the first ones that wasn't a partisan power grab. I mean, the reform proposals in the 80s and the early 90s were very much a Republican attempt to do by initiative what they're going to do at the polls and get a majority. I think the macro, the national thing is that in the last 10 years, the abuse of the redistricting process, particularly in Texas and in other states, not so much California, but in Texas, was so egregious that it raised popular opinion and sensitivity to the issue.
And what about you, Steve? Why do you think it passed Prop 11?
This one is simple. The pro side outspent the no side 10 to 1. 83% of the money was from Republican sources. About 60% was from out of state. The yes campaign with the governor's backing was overwhelming.
I see. That's Steve Maviglio, Democratic Party strategist, publisher of the website California Majority Report, and political communications instructor at Sacramento State, and Tim Hodson, who's a professor and director of the Center for California Studies at Sacramento State. Tim, Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, singer-songwriter Kate Gaffney, and a funny clip about this week's inductions into the California Hall of Fame, one of the inductees remembering with enthusiasm who was there and what happened. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to Insight live online. To stream our show, go to capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, what impact is the freezing weather having on Central Valley crops and growers? Plus, now that the state has stopped funding infrastructure projects, what impact will that have on local projects? Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered. 12 eminent Californians were inducted into the state's Hall of Fame on Monday night. One of them was jazz legend Dave Brubeck, who was born in Ione and who started his career in Northern California. On Tuesday morning, Capital Public Radio producer Paul Conley visited Brubeck at his hotel, where he enthused about the people and happenings the previous night at the Hall of Fame induction.
I just couldn't believe it when Jack LaLanne threw his arms around me. He's 94 years old, and I didn't think he'd remember me. And he said, Dave, it's so good to see you. He was so sharp. Everybody would come up, and Jane Fonda would say, my father thought so much of you, and he played your recordings in our house. Then Quincy Jones, and then Jack Nicholson. Well, I did a story on him that he didn't know about, but he remembered. And Boy, I was so happy when Jack Nicholson started laughing. You don't want him not to laugh.
You can hear more of Paul Conley's interview with Dave Brubeck tomorrow during Morning Edition, right after the 6:30 and 8:30 news. Singer-songwriter Kate Gaffney plays her soulful country, rock, and folk this weekend at Sacramento's Blue Lamp Nightclub. Kate is a Pennsylvanian who moved to Sacramento about 8 years ago. She worked as a social worker, but quit that in 2002 to focus on music. Earlier this year, Kate Gaffney released her second album, The Coachman. When she visited us in July, I started by asking why she moved here.
I originally moved to Sacramento after being in San Francisco for an internship after I graduated Penn State University, and I ended up coming back here. I had a relationship in Sacramento. It was one of those things that brought me back here. I worked for the county as a social worker for child protection and just ended up here because I was in California and wanted to stick around.
And how much music were you doing at that time
when
you were a social worker?
I wasn't really doing much at all. I did it as a hobby, just kind of played to feel good about myself when I was dealing with a lot of the, unfortunately, depression, you know, seeing a lot of sad things working in child protection. It kind of allowed me to just feel better about it, all the bad things I had to see.
Writing songs?
I started writing right after I left my social work job. I wasn't doing much writing prior to that. Writing just kind of came to me. I wrote prose and I wrote, you know, I've always been a writer. I just never wrote songs until after my social work job.
So what were you playing as a hobby?
Like, Bob Dylan songs and some Grateful Dead tunes and Dar Williams and Rolling Stones and just, you know, any of the classic rock stuff that I liked as a kid.
My guest is Kate Gaffney. You're here with guitarist Steve Randall, and you got a song for us, Give It a Whirl.
Yes.
This is from the album.
Corporate boy.
That was very nice. Kate Gaffney, guitarist Steve Randall with the song Give It a Whirl. Kate, you said that when you were still a social worker, you didn't write songs and you just played, you know, Bob Dylan, Grateful Dead. When you quit being a social worker, how did you decide what kind of musician you were going to be?
I actually went to see Jackie Greene play at the Blue Lamp years ago, and his mother was actually a social worker at where I was working. So a coworker said, hey, let's go check out this kid play. I'm like, all right, sure. And it was very inspiring. It was, you know, he played all the types of music that I like to listen to. And I was just, yeah, wow, someone my age doing what, you know, playing the kind of music that I like to hear. And it was just very inspiring and kind of took that as my first, you know, step into trying to write some songs, and just started coming to me very easily.
And you've worked a lot with Jackie, and Jackie Greene wrote a song, Ballad of Sleepy John.
Yeah, that was actually about the Blue Lamp, and it was it's a cool, you know, tune. And he came into the studio to work on this new album, and I asked him, oh, how about you show me how to play that song? And we started playing it, and sure enough, my producer said, we got to cut that. We're putting that on the record. So we did. Mm. And
well, let's listen to some of it. Okay. What kind of music did you grow up with?
I didn't listen to much music in grade school. I played a lot of sports, so music was never really being played much in my house. But when I got to high school, that's when I figured out classic rock. I love classic rock. And,
right.
You know, Grateful Dead and yeah. Bob Dylan and the Stones and you know, Pink Floyd. That was, of course, I learned Wish You Were Here. It was probably the first song I ever learned on guitar, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I listened to just all this. No, I listened to nothing modern when I was a kid, when I was in high school. I listened to all the stuff in the 60s and 70s and gravitated towards that.
There's a bit of a country flavor to a lot of your songs, but you didn't mention anyone that plays that kind of music when you talked about the groups you liked.
Yeah, it's true. I never really was influenced by much country music. I think it's something that's innate in me that I didn't even know was there, because no matter what I tried, we actually tried to make this record, you know, as, you know, try to make it not too country, and I can't really help it, I think. I think maybe because I was born in Florida, it's not very, you know, very country. It's kind of southern, but
yeah.
But yeah, I don't know where the country comes from. It's just there in my brain, in my heart, in my soul.
My guest is Kate Gaffney. We'll leave time here for one more song in the studio. This is Fallen for the Road.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's hear it.
I do like country music, though. Okay.
I could stand here crying in the wind, concern myself with everything I did. On stage.
Very nice. Fallen for the Road. That's yes. Kate Gaffney with Steve Randall. I misspoke earlier when I said your album, The Coachman, is out. It was going to be out earlier this year, but that didn't quite work out. When is it coming out?
It's going to be out on October 7th on Dig Music right here in Sacramento. And October 7th.
And you've been working with a producer in Southern California on this.
Right. A fellow named Barry McGuire, who he produced Amos Lee and worked with Natalie Merchant during her Tiger Lily years. And it was a great, wonderful experience. I found a producer who could help me actualize my vision. So.
And what did anything particular hold up the release? Adding songs?
It was great because I left Philadelphia. I went back to Philadelphia after being in Sacramento and returned. And decided to go to LA to make a record, and I decided making a record was the number one priority. And then once I had that, I was able to come back up to Sacramento and work with Marty Deanda at Dig Music. And so we're just kind of putting all of the ducks in a row and putting it out the right way, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, wonderful songs that I've been listening to, and wish you the best. Kate Gaffney and guitarist Steve Randall, thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Kate Gaffney plays Sacramento's Blue Lamp this Saturday evening. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more on the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up in Capital Public Radio, the dollar fell to a 2.5-month low after the Fed announced yesterday it was slashing target rates to near zero. Plus, Alfredo Flores is a successful U.S. business owner who appears to be living the American dream, only he's not American and faces the constant threat of being deported. Those stories and the rest of the day's business news next on Marketplace. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer was Evan Mansler. Today's director was John Bernaysi. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. California's prisons are overcrowded and judges are trying to decide if the conditions violate prisoners' rights. If so, thousands of inmates might be released. On the next Insight, experts and stakeholders diagnose the problem and tell you how they would solve it. Also, we'll check in with a meteorologist about the weather this weekend and Christmas week. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on KXJZ.